Hello, Brooklyn. How you do? You where you going? We cannot come to. If I can, I'ma be your man. You can be my lady and have my baby and drive my car. You got me crazy. I never get lonely, baby. Where you going? Just take me. I'm so take it. Hello, Nets fans. How you doing? Russell and Fro is back. That's right. We're sneaking one in, a final pod right before the preseason is upon us. How did it sneak up on us? It didn't really. We all knew it was coming quickly, and it still feels like it came quicker than we expected. There's probably a lot of terrible puns there. Carl is biting his tongue. Russell here and Fro there, starring Brett the Man Bun Garofalo and Carl the Talent Jackson. We're excited. We're going to go through a ton of things tonight. Try to keep it quick for you guys. We never do, so get excited for another hour and a half pod. But, you know, let's kick it off with a little question to our buddy Carl here. Carl, how you doing?
Brett, if you're having a problem with coming too quickly, our podcast sponsor, Roman, I believe, will have some pills that can take care of that for you and get you right back out there. No, but seriously, Brett, I'm very excited. Ho, ho, ho. Happy holidays. Let's do some fucking basketball, baby.
Oh, my God. I'm so excited to watch basketball on Christmas again. It's going to make everything feel normal when I have a four-person Christmas.
And it should last at least, you know, I think we get like three quarters in before the whole league gets shut down for positive COVID tests, right? Like, you know, I feel like there have been wiser things than restarting in the midst of this pandemic. But, you know, we'll see what happens.
As of right now, only 18% of NCAA basketball teams have COVID, Carl. That's an entire, 82% of the league that can still play? I mean,
yeah, that's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Yeah, we're doing okay. Things are good. Things are good.
Only represent 700 student athletes, so we'll be fine. No, but seriously, today what we are going to do, not to be, you know, full on Ebenezer Scrooge or anything, but we are going to check in our fears, unknowns, and doubts about the next season. I think, you know, tensions are high. Everybody's excited. Everybody's ready. But there are definitely some lingering concerns throughout the Nets community. And I think our goal here is not to be relentlessly negative. Our goal is actually to, I think, bring them up, talk about them. It's a safe space. Let them out and work to kind of convince ourselves why, you know, maybe we don't need to worry about it. You know, what's the bright side? What's the silver lining in that cloud? So that's what we're going to spend most of the focus on today. But before we do, since it is Christmas, Brett, and since, you know, a particular individual is going to come up in a few of my fears, unknowns, and doubts. So I wanted to take a second to talk as, you know, the guy before all the Harden hoopla today was definitely leading the circus in terms of Nets preseason conversation was a Mr. Kyrie Irving. And, you know, I wanted to say a couple words about Kyrie and I wanted to say a couple words about Christmas. And it just so happened that one of my favorite Christmas films, or at least the Christmas film starring my favorite actor, was on recently. And I couldn't help but notice a quote about the New Jersey Nets. So let's listen. Here we go.
You guys see Van Horn last night?
Oh, beautiful. 32 points.
That kid's going to take the Nets to the championship.
Oh. The Nets? Are you kidding? They suck. But they're due. They certainly do.
So that is, first of all, shouts to the immortal Keith Van Horn. that is an exchange from The Family Man, starring Nicolas Cage, where Nicolas Cage plays like a Wall Street tycoon who, you know, kind of like It's a Wonderful Life, gets a glimpse at what his life would have been like if he had married his college sweetheart and lived out his days in suburban New Jersey. And that line is like a bit of just sort of like a lazy, you know, character building scene where, you know, they're just showing how much of a fish out of water he is at this Christmas party in New Jersey. And I'd say that the Nets are the butt of the joke there, but they're not even dignified with an actual joke, right? There's no punchline. It's just thrown out as like an obvious truth that anybody outside of provincial New Jersey would know about the Nets. And, you know, I feel like that stigma kind of stayed with this franchise, even though they were only 2 years away from going to back-to-back Eastern Conference Finals when this movie came out. And they were, in fairness to the movie, coming off the year that Calipari got fired and they won like 13 games. But I feel like that stigma, that sort of idea that like
the Nets, are you kidding? They suck.
you know, stayed with this franchise really throughout their tenure in New Jersey and still through their tenure in Brooklyn a little bit. I wasn't a New Jersey Nets fan. I joined you guys later in the Brooklyn times. And, you know, it felt to me as kind of like an outsider coming in. It was fascinating to see this team, you know, create this new image that was all hip and cool, you know, Jay-Z, all black, everything, you know, while also trying to kind of lay down these sort of somewhat false roots in their home borough. You know, the Nets have had jerseys since they moved to Brooklyn. The Nets have had jerseys that, you know, are shouts to the Brooklyn Dodgers, to Biggie Smalls. They're going to have Jean-Michel Basquiat this year. And even the Long Island Nets as a sort of extension of Brooklyn eastward. But there was nothing, there's barely anything that even acknowledged that the team played in New Jersey at all. And so the real heritage of the franchise, I feel like, was really not acknowledged. It was something that they were kind of trying to run away from more than celebrate. And so last year, when Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving signed, really the headline from most people was these guys wanted to go to New York, and the Knicks were just such a dumpster fire that they, you know, second option was the Nets. And you know, even the pieces that really were positive about the Nets were really talking about how Brooklyn was selling, you know, the idea to come play basketball in New York. It was selling New York. It wasn't selling the Nets. And that's true to a certain extent. And I think it's probably true for Kevin Durant, but for Kyrie Irving, I'm not sure it is, because, you know, Kyrie signed his contract in a gym in West Orange, New Jersey, even bringing Jay-Z with him. He talked about growing up rooting for the kid era teams. And, you know, for him, I really think that Brooklyn wasn't about New York. It was about the Nets. And by all accounts, you know, even though Katie and Kyrie had decided that they wanted to play together, it really seemed like Kyrie made the move to choose the destination and KD came with him, not the other way around. And I don't think it's coincidence this year that you're going to see, you know, the Nets running out a red, white, and blue New Jersey Nets throwback. And it'll be one of the first jerseys that actually says Nets on the front of it. So, you know, for all of his shit, and believe me, nobody is better at, you know, when dealing with the media, like laying a rake out in front of him, talking about how he doesn't want to step on the rake, stepping on the rake, getting hit in the face, and then blaming just the idea of rakes or the guy who ever first thought of rakes for doing it. And everybody else except for his foot that stepped on the thing that hit himself in the fucking face. And that's frustrating to me, and it's frustrating to you. But let's just not forget, through all of this circus, through all of this craziness, through all of the fear, through all of everything coming into this season, that let's just not forget how we felt at the equivalent point of last season during training camp. And let's not forget that this is the opportunity that we're going to have, the first opportunity that we're going to have to see the vision and the partnership realized of the Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving on court Brooklyn Nets. And the fact that they're doing it with Caris LeVert and Joe Harris and Spencer Dinwiddie and Jared Allen, you know, guys that we have grown sort of watching and loving as part of a core, is really, really fucking cool. So for all the reasons that this might not work, you know, let's just remember how that felt and let's be excited about it, because, you know, Brett, this is the Nets. And are you kidding? The Nets suck. And there's a million fucking reasons for this to go wrong and to blow up in their face. But you know what?
They're due. They certainly do.
The Nets are certainly due. So let's go Nets.
Carl, at the end of the day, they're just rakes. There are so many more important things in life than rakes. So, like, I don't even care, man, you know? Doesn't
very
matter.
True. It's not focusing on the things you should be focusing on.
But I'll throw it back to this. Do you remember the pod we recorded when we were talking about, or when the rumors were it was just Kyrie Irving coming to Brooklyn, and we were going through the pros and cons of, do you sign Kyrie? Do you not sign Kyrie? We were coming off this incredible feel-good season where the team overperformed. There were a lot of young stars that were lovable. Grizzled vets having some of their best throwback seasons to get one last contract or one last chance at glory. And ultimately, even though we weren't excited about Kyrie the person, we're not excited about the controversy, decided, hey, if you're the Nets and you're in a position where the biggest free agent that you've ever signed has been, God, I forget who even called out at the time, but it was not anybody good. You have to sign Kyrie Irving to announce Johan to the Petro? Rest of the league. It was either Johan Petro or Jordan Farmar, probably Jordan Farmar because he was a former champion. Right? Or Sasha Vujacic.
Hollywood guy, that too, right? The machine.
Yeah, he hit those clutch free throws to ice the finals. But yeah, Kyrie alone announced a changing of the guard for this franchise, that this is a place where athletes, where they may not elevate their teams in the specific ways that we want them to, but are considered superstars, do want to play for this franchise. And that was a massive turning point for us. And then Kevin Durant ended up coming along with it. And that was cloud nine. That was, we just got on the podcast and started yelling. So that, those were exciting times. And with all the stuff that's happened since then and the way the world has changed, it's really, really tough to hold over that excitement. And I'm now finally starting to feel it again. And I'm almost giddy about the start of this season and seeing what this team looks like, no matter how constructed. And it was funny listening to you talk about the team separating itself from its New Jersey roots when it made the transition to Brooklyn. I mean, our only homage to New Jersey was Jason Kidd being the coach, and he tried to usurp control of the franchise, left on terrible terms, underperformed as head coach of the Bucks, and eventually won a championship as an assistant coach with the Lakers. So yeah, that didn't turn out so well. So I'm excited that we're coming out with some throwback Nets uniforms. I'm excited to what you said, I'm excited that Kyrie came here because of that history that we built in New Jersey outside of it being where he was born. It's just nice that some folks remember that and it was meaningful to people outside of the small handful of folks that were New Jersey Nets fans at the time and were happy about attending games in the Meadowlands and taking the 2.5 hour drive home, getting no sleep and falling asleep during their class the next day.
Absolutely. So, you know, one love to Gilbert's uncle, Brendan Byrne Arenas. And, you know, we can move on, I guess. But yeah, I just mostly like, I feel like it's so much fun to root for an underdog that's overperforming. And it can kind of be a really shitty experience to root for a team that's supposed to be good that underperforms or doesn't quite live up to your expectations. And I don't want this year to be that. And I just want to keep in mind sort of that this is the Nets and that this is fucking cool. So let's do it. So with that, Brett, I guess, let's pull up a seat on the couch as Nets Twitter, Nets fandom therapists. Why don't you lay out, tell me what you're afraid of, Brett. Tell me some of your fears. Looking at this team, looking at this roster, we can start small. We don't have to dig into the big ones. We'll get there. But tell me something you're scared about.
Yeah, this is a little weird for me because I've never done this before, Carlos. So you're gonna have to bear with me. But I have been reading a lot that getting vulnerable is the best way to form a relationship with others, and I feel like I'm really reaching out to Nets fans with this one. So I was thinking about what happens to me each night, getting ready for bed, floss, brush my teeth, put on my mouth guard to prevent tooth decay from grinding my teeth because I tend to have some anxiety, and get into bed and feel pretty
taking
relaxed.
Those Roman pills.
Right. Take right. a couple Take Roman pills. Roman. Feel a little frisky. Lying on my left side, switch over to my right side, and right before I'm about to fall asleep, my eyes pop open, the anxiety hits, and what are those reasons that I'm lying awake at night, getting 2 hours less sleep than I want to? Many of them have to do with the upcoming Nets season, and the first thing that I thought of is a much maligned topic amongst Nets fans, one that many Nets fans wish we had addressed with certain players I'm sure that we'll name over the next 5 minutes. But that, Carl, is the Nets defense. I fear greatly when it comes to this topic. The Nets don't have a true defensive stopper. We certainly brought in Bruce Brown, who may right off the bat be the second best or best versatile defensive player on the team. And outside of that, because we have very few defense first players, he's definitely either one of two defense first players on the team, the Nets won't be able to elevate their defense enough to contend, knowing that most true contenders have both a top 10 defense and a top 10 offense. And that makes me very afraid, Carl.
Okay, I'm glad you started with this one. So couple things. I have heard this one like so repeated so often within like the NBA like stats community, and you know, really by smart people. And so I don't want to sound like a contrarian douche here, but like, let's put this thing in context, because I think it's really easy, especially coming off free agency, to just sort of look at the sum of the parts and be like, I don't see a great defender on this team. They're going to be terrible. And I don't really think that's the case. I think when we look at the Nets defense, there's two questions we got to ask. One is, how good do they need to be? And two is, how likely are they to get there? As you pointed out, we ran the numbers on, you know, every team that has been to the conference finals since the 2000-2001 season. It's like a sample of 20 or so. 21, I think. I guess it was from the 99-2000 season. Doesn't matter. Really, the key number to look at is top 10. Top 10 offensive rating, top 10 defensive rating. Of the champions, 18 of the 21 were top 10 offensive rating teams. 19 of the 21 were top 10 defensive rating teams. There are certainly outliers, but for the most part, that's the case. Now, I think the thing to take as encouragement for Brooklyn, well, and we can get into whether or not this is a different fear too, but you know, part of the question is, how good is their offense going to be? Because their offense is going to be very, very good. And I think there's reason to believe that it will be good. I think it'll be really good in the regular season. And I think that there's certainly the possibility that it's going to kick to another gear in the playoffs because of the individual shot creators that they have. Their path is to be a team that's a really good offense and a good enough defense. A good enough defense to win the championship is something between sort of 10th and like 7th in the league. Is that attainable for this Brooklyn team? My answer to you, Brett, and I say this fairly unequivocally and without hesitation or reservation, is yes. Brett, would you care to venture a guess as to where the Nets finished in defensive rating last season?
Ooh, I believe that we were 17th.
You are incorrect. We were 10th.
What?
The Nets had a 109.2 defensive rating. That was 10th in the league. I think they were 17th, like overall, maybe in net rating, but they were 10th in defensive rating.
Ah, okay.
I mean, and the sort of secret caveat with this team is like, for the past three years, I think the book on them has been they can score, but they can't defend anybody. And every single season, they finish with a better defensive rating than offensive rating. They were like 14th, I think, the year before. In defense. So how is that possible, and how does that translate to next year? So from the team with the 10th best defensive rating in the league, you're losing Garrett Temple, who your best two defenders last year were Jared Allen, by far, number one, DeAndre Jordan, number two. Garrett Temple is number three. He's your best non-guard defender. He's going away. Bruce Brown is a better defender than Garrett Temple was. Bruce Brown, by most metrics, Raptor defensive box plus minus, is a better defender than DeAndre Jordan is. So that's a pretty positive upgrade overall. Why were they good? What do they do that has made them good the past few seasons? First and foremost, it's the shot profile, right? They were second in the league last year, allowing just 31.2 percent of shots at the rim. And seventh in the league in terms of at-rim field goal percentage, 61.2%. So they're funneling shots to the mid-range. They are doing a decent job defending threes, or maybe getting lucky with some three-point shots. They are doing a great job protecting the rim. And that shot profile is going to find you hidden effectiveness, even if you don't have, you know, elite man-to-man defenders. I think the other thing that's worth noting here is DeAndre Jordan and Jared Allen, and specifically a DeAndre Jordan, Jared Allen tandem, is pretty damn good defensively from the center position. And Allen is better than Jordan by every metric. We can quibble over who starts. I think at the end of the day, I don't know that it matters, because the minutes, or at least it doesn't matter in the regular season, because the minutes distribution is going to be about the same, right? You know, the guy who gets more minutes, the guy who gets less minutes, it's sort of a question of like 24 versus 21. You can go either way. It's not a huge deal. Both players are good. In terms of pick and roll defense, per the play tracking stats on NBA.com, Jared Allen is in the 67th percentile, which doesn't sound great, but when you filter that down to remove guys who you know, defend far fewer possessions as a pick and roll man defender, such as Bruce Brown, who's in the 97th percentile, or Joe Harris, who's in the 80th. So if you look at guys who've had over 50 possessions defended, 50 possessions defended, he's fourth in the entire league behind Giannis, Lauri Markkanen, and Derek Favors. DeAndre Jordan is not much further behind him. He's ninth. The only other team with two guys in the top 10 is Milwaukee, who actually have three, because both Lopez's in addition to Giannis are up there. Allen was better as a pick and roll man defender than Rudy Gobert last year, per that tracking stat. So, you know, I think it's fine and it's fashionable to poke fun at the idea that DeAndre Jordan is going to start over Jared Allen. I disagree with it too. I think either way, you're getting a pretty high quality defensive big, especially if it's Allen. You're getting a really high quality defensive starting center and an exceptionally good backup center. They go legit too deep at a position that most teams don't have one guy. So I think that's worth something as a defensive anchor. And then a lot of the consternation around kind of filling out that defense is like, how good is Kevin Durant going to be? And I don't know the answer to that. But I do know that if we look at whose minutes he's replacing, I don't think the bar is set super high for him that he can't come back and be a positive force there, because most of the minutes that he's replacing are going to be all the minutes played by Wilson Chandler, a significant minutes reduction to Torian Prince, and a bunch of minutes that were filled in by Timothy Luau-Cabarro playing out of position. So for him to be coming in and guarding fours on a team that sort of didn't have a real four last year, I mean, I guess Chandler was, but sort of was in and out and suspended and all that kind of stuff. Like, I don't think that there's a super high bar for him to clear. So I have full faith that he can make a positive impact. So, and then the last thing that I was thinking of is, even if you forget all that stuff for a second, what's another thing that the Nets can do to improve their defense is just, on the offensive end, they can make more shots. It would allow the defense to get set. It's something that is actually interesting. I thought of this from going back and listening to a low post with Stan Van Gundy, where they were talking about Zion Williamson's impact on the Pelicans defense. And they were basically talking about how when Zion played, the Pelicans defense was much better, even though Zion's not really a particularly good defender. How did that happen? Well, the answer was, it seemed like everybody focused a little bit more, which I think you'd think would happen here as well. And with Zion, like, more of their shots were coming at the rim. They were a much higher percentage, you know, make team, and that allowed their defense to get set. And, you know, if you're looking at opportunity areas for the Nets to improve, the Nets actually had a pretty good transition defense. They were sixth in the league in points per possession in transition last year, but they were 21st, so ninth highest in the frequency of transition opportunities allowed. So if you were to cut that down with KD and Kyrie, you know, regardless of whether they do anything on the defensive side of the ball, you know, I think that's another area to potentially improve. And that's something like, even just in the sample that we saw Kyrie last year, their turnover percentage went down. Their effective field goal percentage went up like almost 5 percentage points. So I think there'll be a big impact there. So I'm not saying everybody's wrong that the Nets defense is a concern. It is. But to me, it's a type of concern that you can mitigate with a smaller move. And it's the type of concern where I think for them to get from sort of where they are to good enough is a pretty reasonable, attainable goal. And not something that is as far sort of out of reach as people would make you think. How do you feel, Brett?
It's tough to disagree with that. What I'm struggling with is, how much do we take into account the historicals given the changes of the focal points and the minutes distribution that are coming for this team and the changes to the coaching staff? Who knows what Steve Nash, Mike D'Antoni, and Ime Udoka are going to cook up for this defense? And who knows what another year of Brooklyn vegan dining will do to DeAndre Jordan's already deteriorating body? But I do see your point, and I'm not quite as concerned about that, but I do think that a lot of the reason the Nets finished favorably when it came to defensive rating these past few seasons was more due to Kenny Atkinson's system and the shots distribution. And I don't think that it's fair or safe to assume that that's going to be the same type of thing. Now, we do certainly have the personnel, like you pointed out, at center to have that same type of four shots towards the rim where you have two very capable shot blockers. And please go ahead.
So the one thing is, like, I mean, it is Kenny's system, and there's a version of this where I was going through where I was thinking, you know, the biggest loss on the defensive side of the basketball for the Nets is going to be Kenny Atkinson. But who's their defensive coordinator this year? Like, who's running the defense? It's not Udoku. It's Jacques Vaughn, who I would assume had a pretty big hand in last year's system too. So there is some continuity there. And the other thing on in terms of, like, how does it work when, you know, Kyrie's getting more minutes, for instance, isn't that going to make it worse? Yes, probably. But it's not like the guys that the Nets were funneling in there were world beaters on defense either. I mean, with the exception of David Nwaba, like, I mean, Chandler's okay. Torian Prince's metrics actually not that bad, but he's back. Like, you know, Dinwiddie is fine. Harris is fine. Like, you know, like, they've got guys that are good that are still going to be there in big roles, but it's not like, you know, oh, you know, Kyrie went down, so they were starting Chris Dunn or something like that.
Jacques Vaughn's a figurehead. Come on. We paid that dude so we wouldn't look terrible. We have to show the league that we take care of at least some of our guys. We fired the rest of the assistant coaching staff out.
We didn't have to put him in charge of the defense, Brett. You could have easily made him a figurehead and not done that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, that's true. Nobody knows what goes on behind closed doors, and the public can believe what they want, right? So he'll probably get a great job after this. We took care of Jacques Vaughn. I'm happy for the guy.
JV's I have a different read on that situation, man. I think JV's a Sean Marks guy through and through. Sean put him on Kenny's staff. You know, Kenny can bring in Jordan Ott all he wants, but Sean was like, Jacques Vaughn is your guy, and Jacques Vaughn survived the purge.
Hey, listen, as long as we keep him away from the offense, I'm good.
Fair enough.
but I'm with you. I mean, listen, as long as we put in place a system that builds around the strengths and weaknesses of our best players, then the defense shouldn't be that bad. And as long as the players buy in, then the defense should actually be above average. It's just a matter of when we get to the playoffs and the minutes really, really focus on who our best players are and most likely who our best offensive players are, does that hold up? And does that hold up when other teams have every single night and every single game to prepare for whatever system the Nets have put in place? And that's where I worry most about it.
Yeah, and that's very fair. I think from that perspective, you know, you're probably still a player away. I guess the question to me is, like, are you a player away, and is that player, you know, Drew Holiday, like a Drew Holiday level defender, or is that, could that player be, you know, much, much more attainable either, you know, through a pretty lateral trade like a Torian Prince trade or a like on the buyout market? So, you know, I think you'll see somebody else flow in there. It's just a question of, like, you know, who is that player and, you know, how much they have to expend to get him. So.
Agreed. Well, let me just clarify what I'm saying too. I think I agree with you to the extent that I think the Nets will be fine until the second round of the playoffs. And that's where we can really see some of these cracks starting to form and show as fatal flaws for our team. And there's that concept of, okay, the first round, if you're a contending team, you don't really need to prepare for that. But beyond that, you're going to have teams with smart coaches, versatile players that can really plan around those cracks. And that's, I think, where we're really, really going to be able to tell if we've prepared adequately enough personnel and scheme wise to be able to compete for a championship defensively, which is why even if we start the season, the defensive rating is great. We're not really going to know if it's great until the second round of the playoffs. And that's like partially the fun yet terrifying thing of this team, because there are so, so many unknowns. And I really don't think there's any other team like that in the NBA.
Champagne problems, Brett. No, that's very fair point. And I guess you're not on the Uncle Jeff Green train. As being our defensive, you know, key cornerstone there. So, I don't know.
He's a great friend of Kevin Durant, Carl.
Uncle Hefe, baby. May I take a turn on the couch here, my friend?
Please, Carl, sit down, relax. This is a safe space. It's been a tough year for all of us. Please speak your mind.
So, what I want to talk about is there are a few sort of sub-bullets within this sphere, but just generally around, not necessarily, this isn't a fear about Steve Nash, but but just the job that Steve Nash has to do, what this is going to look like in the locker room. I mean, with the amount of power that, that Kyrie and KD wield, the amount of nonsense and controversy that, that Kyrie seems to, you know, pull out of thin air at the snap of a finger. Jared Allen, what his confidence is going to be like losing his starting job to DeAndre Jordan, you know, how he handles that. I mean, I think some of his media interviews have been fairly concerning so far. He seems to be, like, of all the guys, he seems to be negative, and he's not, you know, Caris LeVert, Taurean Prince, like those guys are in the Kevin Durant tree of trust, and I don't think Jared Allen is. So that's a concern. And then I guess my biggest concern locker room wise is, like, if this all does go bad and it implodes, like, what happens beyond this season? Is it going to be like a James Harden Westbrook situation where KD and Kyrie are basically, you know, zero sum game for who can get the fuck out of town the fastest, or what's it going to be like? So Brett, help me out. Soothe me.
We'll do, I think we'll go in reverse order, Carl, because I think these are concerns that many Nets fans share, and it's the underlying reason for a lot of the tension on Twitter recently. We all want to believe.
I really like your soothing voice, Brett. Very nice.
Well, we all want to believe, Carl.
I have my headphones on. I feel like I'm like listening to an ASMR or something.
This is,
speaking of taking your Roman pills.
Late night basketball jazz with Brett and Carl. Kyrie Irving is a master on the court, much like a blazing John Coltrane saxophone solo from 1971. So we'll go in reverse order here. I will say that, let's say things do go incredibly worse than expected. There are injury concerns. KD and Kyrie realize that, hey, it was great when we were friends, but now we're coworkers, and this isn't working out so great, as many of us have found starting a business or working alongside people that we were friends with beforehand. Sometimes respecting somebody in life isn't the same as respecting somebody in a professional setting. And if that does happen, you could easily see one of them making a side comment, the other one realizing that the writing's on the wall, demanding a trade, and this whole thing going south real quick. Now, I am not too afraid of that, because even if it does go south, these two players are still going to be extremely sought after this season or after next season, because A, we're going to be back in arenas. Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving put butts in seats. And B, hell, Gordon Hayward just got $120 million. So even if there are injury concerns related to these two players, I still think there's going to be interest from teams out there, and we're going to be able to get a very sizable haul in return for them. And if you look at the depth of the draft classes over the next 3 years, there are a lot of very, very dynamic playmaking wings out there. And I think that the rebuild would be much, much swifter, because this time Sean Merks would be working with a full chest of draft assets versus having to pick players out of the dredges of NBA castaways, swimming in the ocean, tracking down volleyballs named Wilson, throwing them on the court and hoping they work well enough so he can absorb terrible contracts for late first round draft picks. So it's never.
The volleyballs are named Wilson Chandler, right?
Yes, that's I should have made that joke. Damn it. Oh, Wilson Chandler.
Sorry, I'm here for a Jared Allen tip in, or a DeAndre Jordan stationary feet on the ground rebound put back.
Or Spencer Dinwiddie just threw a lob pass 2 feet above DeAndre Jordan's head because he thought it was 2015.
Yeah, which was also 6 inches below the rim. But whatever.
It's going to be a fun season, Carl, but there's no way it's ever going to be as bad as it was after the Billy King era. And I would love to see Sean Marks go through a rebuild with a reestablished culture of, hey, stars do want to play in Brooklyn. I can't see Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant saying bad things about Brooklyn. It would just be, hey, it just didn't work out personnel or health-wise. And we'd have a lot of assets in draft picks. So I don't think that that's going to be the worst thing in the world. It would just stink because we're all – expecting this to be our best shot at a championship, maybe ever. And once this is over, we'll probably never get back to a point where we have this much star power on one team. So that would be the disappointing part, but we won't be in that bad of a position. Let's go to...
So you really go reassured ahead. Me there by taking me to a far, far darker place than I anticipated.
I like to think about worst case scenario. And quite frankly, the Nets have already had their worst case scenario, Carl. We've gone through it. So worst case scenario here is still not going to be anywhere near where we were when Sean Marks took over this team. And you know what? We needed to hit rock bottom to get here.
It's like I went to the doctor for a fucking sinus infection and you're telling me that I'm going to die in 5 days, but it's okay because the afterlife's cool.
Yeah, I took my dog in for a regularly scheduled tooth checkup, and it turns out he has terminal cancer. So great, this is going well.
Quick parting thought on this one before I move on to meteor topics. Do you have concerns? I guess what's your read just on the locker room issues causing problems for this team this year in season?
My read is very, very low. I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, look at what Kyrie Irving did the last time. He was the second best player on a team, or at least the second best player as recognized by other players in the league, regardless of how Kevin Durant's health turns out. 3 straight finals appearances, game 7 game winning shot, incredible playoff performances, and hell, that last year he was unhappy. And they still made the finals. So this is his choice to be here. I really don't see that being that much of an issue this season. And it's one of those things where they say winning hides all sins. You know what? There's going to be Kyrie Irving flare-ups. Of course there are. Weird stuff that he says in the media, leaving teammates out of comments, the body language on the court, whatever people are going to be able to pick up about him. But if the Nets are winning – and they're fun to watch, those become more of a, oh, Kyrie, oh, you, versus focus on basketball, you idiot. Make a damn free throw. Play some defense. You know, like it fixes everything very, very quickly. So I think that this season is going to be a bit of a honeymoon period because we're going to be so excited to watch these folks, and we're not going to have things to nitpick about a failed postseason run or falling shorter than we thought or people not making clutch shots. And then after that, that's when the real work begins in terms of, okay, well, did we not win in the playoffs because we weren't healthy enough and now we're back at that spot? Or do we need to make major overhaul changes, and how does that affect the stars who might not be able to play at a level that they were expecting to?
So first off, excellent heckles. Second off, I agree with you. I think that I am far, far, far less concerned about, you know, Kyrie's shenanigans penetrating the harmonious atmosphere of the Nets locker room. You know, I'm far less concerned about that than I am about, you know, Kyrie's shenanigans penetrating the harmonious atmosphere of my own enjoyment of the Nets personally, because I do think that they'll be quite annoying. But I think that, you know, I think, like you said, you know, he signed up to be here, and it frankly, you know, people, players in the NBA like him, and this locker room seems super behind him, with the possible exception of Jared Allen, which I mentioned before, and that is concerning. But you know, I don't think that'll be a problem. I don't think any sort of KD Kyrie stuff will really be an issue. The Harden rumors and how that works is, yeah, maybe a little bit more concerning, but I feel for like Caris LeVert getting asked today about James Harden not reporting to Rockets practice and basically being like, fuck you. Like,
Hey, well, hey, listen, let me put it this way. It's either not going to be an issue because they're already saying the right things. These guys are old enough and gone through enough shit that they just want to fit in, and they know that they're not the best players in the team. And I've quite frankly have never seen a team with this many dominant ball handlers that have the guys that scored 20 points per game and led the team to the playoffs and were stars in their own right in the previous season say, yeah, it's all about us just getting the ball into our best players' hands and working around them. So that's a major positive. We'll be fine if they're here, but in reality, they're probably not going to be here, Carl. So this is a moot point. Jared Allen, he doesn't like playing with Kyrie Irving. Cool. Do you like playing with John Wall? Enjoy. Hey, Caris LeVert, yeah, you want the ball? You want a chance to show that you can be a star in this league? Awesome. Houston's a huge city. Big market. Enjoy.
Great barbecue.
great barbecue. Surprisingly large Vietnamese community.
Yeah. Listen, you and I are opposed right now because I'm anti-James Harden trade just for my own emotional enjoyment. But and obviously, Karis would not have said F you to the media. He's a much more respectful young man than that. That is me being a salty old bastard. But anyway, you know what? We've belabored this enough. Let's move on. Is it my fear next or yours? It's your fear next, right?
I believe it is my fear next. And we're going to talk about something that is really the biggest unknown of this team and something that does really keep me up at night. And there's nothing that talks of wild scrimmages in Los Angeles and players looking better than ever and certain people commenting like, man, he's back, can do to really quell my fears here. It's the dragon that we have to slay, one that who knows how long it'll take to actually see this, but let me just walk you through a couple things. So, KD, Kevin Durant, Durantula, he tore his Achilles. That is a long,
really?
Long road to recovery. He did.
I never read about that.
It didn't happen on the Nets, and it happened on a low-profile team in like a meaningless preseason game. So you probably didn't hear about it. So that's it's been a big deal though. We've talked about this ad nauseum. It looks like it takes 2+ years to recover from an Achilles injury. To remind everybody, that injury date was June 10th, 2019. The 2021 regular season starts on December 22nd, not to mention two preseason games prior. And interestingly, the Nets have chosen to play two when they had the opportunity to select three or four. December 22nd is roughly a year and a half in to Kevin Durant's Achilles recovery. The 2021 playoffs start on May 22nd. A lot of 22nds in here. That is still not past the two-year mark from Kevin Durant's original injury date. So we're looking at him maybe climbing over that hump by the start of the NBA Finals, if the Nets even get there. And to me, that is that's super concerning. And that's just one element of potential roster fit, things that could affect the Nets on court. Because this entire roster right now is constructed around funneling the ball to Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving as a secondary option. And if that turns out not to be our best option, that's going to be really interesting to watch. So, Carl, I don't know if there's anything you can say to make me feel better here, but that's something that makes me sad.
Yeah, I mean, obvious counterpoint, Brett. Have you ever watched a sports movie before? Because I'm pretty sure, like, the team's best player having to lay low for the entire season so that his ragtag group of teammates form confidence in themselves and bring themselves to a higher level of playing just in time for that good player to come back into the fold and lead them to victory is it's kind of the whole deal. So the way that you're talking about it in terms of like the 2 year mark is, I think, it's tough, but it's somewhat optimistic. I have sort of always felt like, this year was going to be the puncher's chance and next year was going to be the real chance at a title, just in terms of being able to run it back with some continuity. So that would sort of fit into this in terms of, KD being able to make strides and become better. I think the real fear with his Achilles rehab is just that he's just not going to reach close to the levels that he was before. And that I don't really have the ship has sunk at that point. In my view, I just don't think that there's like, well, I suppose if you trade for James Harden, maybe it's a different conversation, but with the roster as presently constructed, like I think that puts a pretty hard ceiling on where things could go. But the 2 year thing, the 2 year thing is concerning, and I agree that sort of punting, 9 months of a 2 year window is like a big deal. So I don't mean to belittle that, but like, I do feel like him, if anything, there's optimism in me that like he can continue to improve throughout the course of this season. So I don't know if that's much help, but it was at least sarcastic and a little bit, you know, pedantic.
I'd like to address something first. I am a little offended about your take on my lack of sports movie knowledge. I've seen Air Bud and all of the sequels, including Seventh Inning Fetch, Air Bud Spikes Back, Air Buddies, and Air Bud World Pup. So,
did you see The Big Green with me in movie theaters? Or is that a different? It may not have been you.
I don't remember, but that and Little Giants are two all-time classic sports movies.
One of my favorite movie theater moments with the kids behind us, like, threw a bag of popcorn in the air at the winning save sequence by the kid that everybody said that I look like because I was fat as a child. So, you know, good times. Anyway,
This really is a therapy session.
We're just letting it all out, man.
I didn't even have red hair.
Like the guy that looked like Ham Porter from the Sandlot, but wasn't. I think he's an actor. But anyway, continue.
And yeah, you're right. The 2 year thing is completely arbitrary, and you can see so many points and counterpoints to the injury timeline and the injury risk based on where his Achilles tore, how Kevin Durant shoots, what leg it's more optimal to get an Achilles injury on, and like who the heck knows if that's true or not. None of us are doctors, and certainly none of the people listening to this show are doctors. So that's for us to pontificate and pretend that we know more about when we see some random guy claiming he's a doctor on Reddit and go through all these injuries where who knows who this guy is. Could just be a software engineer sitting somewhere. All right. So, you know, go ahead.
So sorry. I was going to give you a new one, but are you good with that one?
Yeah, no, let's go. I'm ready.
I mean, that was a big one, right? Like that's the biggest red flag. I think that's the reddest of flags with this team. So acknowledged, it's out in the open. We're stronger for knowing it's there. Here's mine. When you sort of deconstruct a lot of the concerns that people had around free agency in terms of not getting like Wes Matthews or not getting Nick Batum or crap like that, you know, to me, it all sort of comes back to we watch the NBA in an era in which two-way wings are the most coveted players in the league to the point where like Joe Harris, who is certainly a shooter and is like not bad on the defensive end. He's not good, but he's not bad. You know, he gets paid $18 million a year, like a pretty significant role player contract with that player profile. Part of the concern as a Nets fan is you have gone and tried to build a team where two superstars don't play that position. You don't really have two-way wings. I mean, KD, I think, you know, kind of qualifies as a wing. He's sort of his own thing. I think right now, coming off the Achilles tear, is only going to defend fours. So that's a concern, right? And to me, it comes down a little bit to the conversation on Kyrie Irving and the conversation on his contributions to winning basketball and why when he's sat the past few years, teams haven't gotten worse and what it means to dedicate max money and max resources and max usage to a point guard. And listen, I love Kyrie for all the reasons that I said at the beginning, and I take none of it back, and I love watching him, and I'm excited to see him play. But here's my thoughts on Kyrie, right? Kyrie Irving was the number one recruit coming out of high school. He went to Duke, one of the top programs in the country. He played most of that year and got hurt, was the number one pick in the draft. He is somebody who has a sterling reputation within basketball. And I have said personally, like he is one of the people that when I watch, like I have been most impressed by watching in person, just the things that he can do with the basketball, the handle that he has is just completely incredible. What I feel like with him is because of his pedigree and because he has a skill set that I think everybody in the league, you know, everybody in the league handles the basketball. Everybody in the league wants to be able to do the kinds of things that he's really good at doing. You know, taking guys off the dribble, creating his own shot, being able to do things kind of all by himself. Like, I think if there were a horse game in amongst all of NBA players, I think, you know, Kyrie Irving probably Steph Curry and Trae Young would be the top three guys in that game. You know, Curry and Young because of their crazy shit that they can do from beyond the arc, and Kyrie because like he can just make insane shots at insane angles and finish stuff that nobody else can. I think all of that put together, like the fact that from a sort of basketball, like Kyrie always likes to refer to himself as like an artist. I sort of think of him as like a basketball craftsman. Like the fact that his craft of handling a basketball, his craft of like being able to get to the rim and create shots for himself is really better than almost anybody else in the league. Like, I think all of that leads to a reputation that is outsized compared to the impact he makes within the context of a basketball team. Because, you know, his ability to do things that are harder than everybody else, or you know, do things that, with a higher degree of difficulty than everybody else, is fine and good in a very, very, very extremely limited specific situation. You know, game seven of the finals, you need somebody to make a crazy layup, which he did, in fairness, on the 2016 Cavs, and that helped win them the finals, and making that three-pointer helped them win the finals. I'm not taking it away from him. But, like, I do feel like what he can do and what Spencer Dinwiddie can do are not really all that different. The difference is that Kyrie does it and makes it look harder, and, you know, Spencer probably doesn't do it quite as well, and admittedly doesn't do it quite as well, but costs a third of the amount and allows you to place your resources elsewhere. And, you know, for Kyrie to be able to do what he does on the offensive end while bringing as little as he does on the defensive end, it just sort of means that it just sort of adds up to, like, I think a reputation and, you know, entertainment value that outmatches his actual contribution to winning basketball. And to have him be the second guy in a big two where you're worried about the other guy being hurt, it's concerning to me, right? It's another area where I see this not working. So help me out with that one. Talk me through it.
Well, first of all, I agree with your assessment of Kyrie's skill set. I think that he is most valuable when you have the team infrastructure around him to get him to the moments where high degree of difficulty play and shot making is at a premium. And that might not be as niche as game seven of the NBA finals, but going back to what we were talking about earlier with the Nets defense, John Hollinger and Nate Duncan brought up this premise of players that are there for the second round of the playoffs and beyond. And when you are a contender and you're constructing your team, you want to have focus on more of those players. They're going to get those meaningful minutes in the second round and beyond. And the goal is to get to that point as healthy as possible so you can take advantage of it. And the Warriors had a great example of that by continuing to extend Andre Iguodala's contract, where he didn't play a lot of regular season minutes. And when he did, he didn't particularly try very hard. But when it came to the playoffs, he was doing everything. He was their Swiss Army knife, and he was guarding LeBron James, knocking the ball out of his hands on last-second possessions in the NBA Finals. And that's how we have to assess how effective Kyrie Irving is going to be for this team. We need to base that decision on, does the rest of the Nets team seem good enough to get him into a position where he can help elevate us over defenses that take whatever offense Nash and D'Antoni have constructed, break it down, muck up the play so somebody has to go one-on-one, dribble around somebody, do an inside-out dribble, do a spin, back around, spin, fake up, spin around, probably travel twice in this description and still put the ball in plus get fouled, or pull up for I'm also grabbing my ball's three-pointer that swishes in over another superstar all-star player that might be better than you for 72 games but isn't better for you in that moment. And that's what we have to assess. I personally think that the Nets are a good enough team around Kyrie Irving to get to that second round and beyond where he can really shine. But that remains to be seen, and there could be some things that happen during the regular season. But if those do happen, then hell, like those injuries do happen, then we probably weren't going to win a championship anyway. So I'm not as concerned about that, especially with the multiple ball handlers that we have on this team. And let's say we do make a James Harden or a Bradley Beal trade, that still brings in a tertiary ball handler that doesn't have to. That creates a team atmosphere where we don't have to rely on Kyrie Irving as that guy to elevate the entire efficiency of the team on offense. So I'm not really too worried about that. I think we're actually well constructed to take advantage of what Kyrie's best at and have some really fun moments along the way.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly no shortage of fun with him. And to be clear, like, I do think the Nets are more efficient offensively when he's playing. I think that was true last year during the, you know, regular season games that he played. Like, I don't think it's like it's an inefficiency, like, you know, it's not like he's getting popcorn stats or anything like that. Like, I do think he's a very efficient player. I just think, you know, to a certain extent, it's like you can get close enough to the efficiency that he's bringing as a team, you know, without everything being concentrated through one guy, and get more on the defensive end, basically, I think is ultimately what it is. But I think you're right. I think, you know, the reason that he's respected and sort of some of the reason I think, you know, between, you know, to oversimplify things, like I think some of the gap between the way analytics people see basketball and the way that players sometimes see basketball is really just as simple as, you know, what you see over large samples versus what you see over small samples. And, you know, over small samples, you want guys who can, you know, break down their opponent by themselves and get their own shot off and, you know, be able to be on an island with a basketball and make something happen. And, you know, part of it, I think, with Kyrie is that the Nets didn't really get him there last year, or he didn't have the opportunity last year. So, you know, hopefully they'll get there this year. So I'm with you. You made me feel better, I think.
Well, and listen, look at how seriously he took the beginning of last season when we went into it not having any idea what the Nets' chances were of making a splash and making an impact in the playoffs. When it became pretty clear that this team was not going to be the best team in the NBA or not have a chance to really have some fun in the playoffs, he checked out a little bit. And I don't think that's going to be the case this season, because even if Kevin Durant isn't 100% or isn't as good as we all think that he's going to be, we're still going to have a very, very strong shot at making the second round of the playoffs and making some noise. Plus, he made a commitment to his friend. Hell, he recorded two podcast episodes with him.
That's true. That's true. That's a bond you cannot break. All right. So, given that we're coming up pretty late here on the hour, why don't we? You want to go lightning around through the next few?
Yeah. Do you want to
keep yelling about?
Yeah, let's talk about some of the weirdness that's going to happen this season. So I think those are some other minute fears to watch here. So number one, this is not an 82-game season. This is a 72-game season. And first of all, what that means is even though teams might be percentage-wise mathematically out of it, there's less runway and less of an apparent gap in the overall wins and losses and the record to make these teams believe that they're truly out of playoff contention. And because of that, there might be less candidates available on the buyout market, making the perceived lack of roster upgrades that many Nets fans believe the Nets failed to make all that more apparent when there aren't those massive upgrades that could really help us in the playoffs to make. Like, for example, I wrote, if the Hornets are still in it for the 10th seed, how in God's name are we going to steal Cody Zeller from them and have that stretch five we've been hoping for all of these years? But that's also on top of there's now a play-in game. So even if you are out of the 8th seed towards the end of the season, if you're a 9th or a 10th seed, you could theoretically still go on a run in the playoff tournament or in the play-in tournament and still make the postseason. And even though there might not be butts in the seats then, that's still valuable for a lot of these franchises that have been middling and struggling for a number of years, like the Bulls and the Hornets and the Hawks and the Magic, who don't have much else to write home about except a lot of these eighth seed appearances. So I think that that could be a major concern. And then also another weird part about this season is this 72 games. Okay, it's less. So you would think, well, this is going to be less of a burden on the players. Unfortunately, it's condensed into a shorter amount of overall days. So we're talking 72 games in 146 days, and that includes the All-Star break. Typically, teams play 82 in roughly 160 days. So that's about 8% less rest league-wide. We're already experiencing load management issues. With the league, so either our stars aren't going to play a significantly more amount of games than we were expecting. And if that happens, not the worst thing in the world, but maybe that's where the Nets' depth of ball handlers really creates fool's gold for us as fans. And we have to say, okay, we looked great in the regular season, but we never got to see the true playoff lineups. How many minutes did Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant really play together? And when we get to the playoffs and we really focus and hone in on those lineups and having our best players together, does that actually make us one of the better teams? Or does that make us one of the teams best suited to survive during this very, very weird regular season? So what I guess overall what I'm saying is we might be better constructed to have a better showing in the regular season right now than the postseason, and we could be due for disappointment. I was all over the place there, but those are all weird season related fears.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess like my biggest thing with the last one is like, aside from protecting our own individual feelings, which, you know, I suppose with the being the sort of Nets therapy episode that it is, like, we should acknowledge, but I really don't necessarily think that that's that big of a problem. Like, I think going into the playoffs overseas, I mean, if it prevents them from making, you know, from seeing an upgrade that they need to make, I suppose that could be an issue. But if all it means is that they're going to go into the playoffs overseeded from where they should be because they have more depth, I don't think it's that big of an issue given the way that they're constructed with the two stars at the top and for all the reasons that we talked about in my Kyrie concerns, you know, segment, because, you know, they have guys that are built to succeed in the playoffs, at least offensively. And so I'm not worried about the fool's gold piece of it so much. I'm a little bit worried about, you know, you are going to have to rest guys, you know, in particular, you know, working guys back from injury, given that some of the rest is going to be dictated by like TV matchups and TV contracts which we just learned today, you know, in terms of, you know, Chris Haynes reporting about the restrictions on resting guys for national TV games. You know, is that going to push you into, you know, weird matchups or weird alignments? Are the extra games, you know, on short rest going to mean that you're going to have to rest more guys? Like, I think the Nets are well positioned for that because of their depth. But that could also lead to just a general sort of lack of cohesiveness, and that could be a problem too. But I'm less concerned about it. It's one of the reasons that I have liked the way that the Nets are set up. It's why I've liked that they haven't consolidated some of their role players. And it's why, you know, if teams, you know, like I heard Dave Dufour on the Game Theory podcast with Sam Vecenie today talking about how like the Nets are sort of in the same position that the Clippers were in last year in terms of, you know, having, you know, a team that's going to underperform their talent level because of redundancy. You know, they have redundancy in different areas, but to me, like, I don't think that that's necessarily the case because you're going to have so many scenarios where guys that are redundant to each other aren't able to all play in the same game. And it's a little bit different than like trying to run Al Horford and Joel Embiid out and have a decent defense, because, you know, you're going to have opportunities to play Spencer Dinwiddie in a game that Kyrie Irving is not playing, and play Caris LeVert in a game that neither of those guys are playing. So, I think it'll be a weird season, but I do think the Nets are kind of well positioned for it. So it's not something that I'm terribly afraid of, I guess, overall.
Yeah, Caris LeVert and Spencer Dinwiddie have 72 games to figure out how to play off ball. They're both super intelligent guys. They can figure it out.
Yeah, I worry a little bit. You know, if DeAndre Jordan's going to take 20 games to play himself back into shape, that's now 30% of the season instead of just 25. So, you know, maybe that's a challenge. But, you know, overall, I actually think the Nets returning as much of their core, like, I think that helps in the weirdness because of that, because of the cohesiveness. I guess one last maybe parting fear that I have, and it's related to the weirdness, is like, because this year is so weird and because it it's not a throwaway year necessarily, but like the Nets realistically have a 2-year window here, right? One of these years you are introducing all of this uncertainty due to COVID, which could help, could hurt. We don't know. Beyond that, there's really only one real year left. So as a fan, like number one, like I think it sucks that, you know, the Nets have created this 3-year run and are spending 2 of it without any fans in the stands. That sucks. Number two, you know, you don't know how this year's going to go. Does something from this year, does a player getting sick, something like that, like really, torpedo one of the seasons that you had? And then the other one is, you know, of the 2 years that you have left, they're not really created equal. This year is the Nets are a much better position because Spencer Dinwiddie's player option is coming up next season. He's almost definitely going to decline that. That's going to become a money squeeze, you know, for the Nets to have to figure out. Jared Allen coming up for contract or coming up for a qualifying offer is going to become a money squeeze the Nets are going to have to figure out. So you're investing a lot of opportunity into this one season. And it's admittedly a weird season. And I don't know if that helps or hurts, but I feel like that's a concern to bring up as well.
I think it is, but I don't know. This is always going to be a 2-year window. And if it doesn't happen this year, all that means for me is that it's going to happen when we can have fans in the seats. And I will go back to, if this goes wrong and we have to blow it up, it will never, ever be worse than it was. So regardless of what we have to do with Spencer Dinwiddie and Jared Allen's contracts, and let's be honest, they're going to be traded for James Harden anyway, so it doesn't matter. But let's say that theoretically that doesn't happen, and all of James Harden's mom's Instagram posts and his sister saying my pain is your pain and him posting weird emojis and him asking for his $30 million contract in singles so he can continue to be in Vegas over the next couple weeks, breaking every possible and conceivable and thought of and not thought of COVID protocol the NBA and Adam Silver could come up with. If that doesn't happen, I think those are concerns, but I do think that we're probably going to see some weird stuff.
Do you think if James Harden's mom does force his trade to the Nets based on her Instagram comments that Joe Harris has to get James Harden's mom tattooed on his arm as well?
Is that what he got tattooed? I didn't see it. I just saw that he got a tattoo. Did he get his mom tattooed in his arm?
Yeah, it's his mom and his grandma. I think it'd be great if it was a tat sleeve of all moms.
I really wish it was a tattoo of him beating Steph Curry in his hometown at the 3-point contest.
That would be sweet too. And you know, I'm being facetious because I finished my whiskey, but I'm also a little bit serious. One love to moms.
No, for real, it's a badass tattoo.
That's pretty great. All right. Well, Brett, do you feel our conversation has helped you feel better about the Nets season overall? Are there any final takeaways that you want to give the people?
I'll throw this out there. I'm not even concerned about the trade rumors. I don't really care what happens there. I just know I'm going to feel so much better once I actually see this team on the court. It's been so much speculation, uncertainty, tension, infighting amongst the fans, pot shots taken from the rest of the league, little YouTube clips or Instagram videos that you're not sure what to believe or not, because of course these are put out by Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving's people and they want to make them look great. Comments by some of their good friends. I just want to see these guys on the court, see how much they enjoy playing the game, enjoy playing with each other, how good they look against the other top athletes that are also playing their butts off out there. And once Nets fans see that and see how much fun it is to watch this team and things look okay, then I think all fears are going to subside. And that is coming up pretty damn quick.
Yeah, man, I can't wait to see it. And I think, you know, what I said at the beginning, I think really holds true for me, right? Like I just have to transport myself back to where we were, whatever, 2 Julys ago, thinking about how incredible it was that these free agents wanted to sign with the Nets, and realizing that this is the first opportunity that we get to see that come to fruition, and sort of all of the additional ballyhoo of like, is Caris LeVert going to be the third star? Are they going to trade for a third star? Like, are they going to get guys to sign for less? And did they, you know, did they accomplish that? Do they have the right role players? Do the pieces fit together? Blah, 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 blah. Like, let's just take it for what it is. Like, these are a lot of fun players, a lot of guys that I enjoy watching play the game. I'm excited to see what they can do together. And, you know, from everything that I read of Steve Nash as a coach and as a spokesman for this group, like, I want to fucking play for him. I want to work for him. Like, he seems fantastic. So if anybody can bring them together, like, I have faith that he can. And, you know, let's check it out. Like I'm pumped.
And listen, you don't want the Nets. You don't want guys to come to the Nets and take discounts, right? That's not the brand that the Nets have created for themselves. The Nets take care of their players. They take care of their players' friends. And that's why people want to play for us. If we start being known as the organization that players take less to play for, that's not going to be a good look for the Nets in the league. So all of these people that are saying that we were promised that people would take less to play for the Nets, we were never promised that. And in fact, I think that's antithetical to the culture that the Nets have built.
For sure, man. If the Nets are about one thing and one thing only, it's getting their guys paid. So with that in mind, Brett, you know, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, all the holidays, Happy New Year. Let's do this. Let's run it back. Let's get the preseason. Let's go into the season and let's make some magic, man. Let's make some miracles. Let's go Nets.
But most of all, a happy non-denominational beginning to the 2021 NBA season.
Absolutely. If you like what you heard, you can follow us at Russell and Fro. You can email us russellandfro@gmail.com. You can reach out any other way, carrier pigeon, whatever. Anything else to say to the people before we log off?
Let's freaking do this, Nets.
Let's go. With hard knocks, better than Berkeley. They said you murdered me by the time I was 21. That shit disturbed me, but you never hurt me. Hello, Brooklyn. We had a daughter. Guess what I'ma call her? Brooklyn Carter. When I left you for Virginia, it didn't offend you. Cause you know I only stepped out to get dinner. Hello, Brooklyn. How you doing?
Are you kidding? They suck.